again, everyone, and welcome to it. Oh, ooh, there's 2 hours of my life I'll never get back again. I'm Derek Hunter. This is the Daily Daily Caller Podcast for the last weekday of June 2019. It's June 28th. Don't go rushing to your calendar feature on your phone going, what is it? It's the 28th of June. It is a Friday, which means the weekend is upon us. Oh, man. And after these last 2 days, we really could use it. There were some fireworks. I'm Derek Hunter. Did I say that? I don't know. I'm slap happy right now. Oh, you can email me, Derek, at dailycaller.com. D-E-R-E-K is the spelling of that. And you can send any complaints, compliments, whatever you want. And programming note, next week, I am running the, you know, some of the best interviews that we've done in the past year. The show's a little over a year old, and I am going to take some time to play with my kids and let them crawl on me and do whatever it is they do, which seems to be like pull my hair and somehow put all of their weight in one particular spot, like on the top of my foot. You wouldn't think a two-year-old could step on the top of your foot and it would be like dropping a brick on it. But that's how it is. But that's what they like to do. And I want to spend some time with them doing it. Everybody keeps emailing me, this time flies by. You better enjoy it while you can. So I'm going to take you up on that suggestion. Although I do have to say that if the years in diapers flew by, I could live with that. But they're a lot of fun. So I want to enjoy it since it's a short week anyway. You'll still get 5 shows next week. The one on Friday will be new, brand spanking. It's an interview with Dan Gaynor from the Media Research Center. I asked him to pull together the 10 worst media fumbles from the first 6 months of 2019. The year is just full of too many to do, you know, a year-end thing. Couldn't do it justice. So I'm doing a half-year thing. So you'll have that coming up on Friday. On today's program, we have about 25 minutes together. And then I had a really, really interesting conversation with Christopher Scalia. And if that last name sounds familiar, it's because he is the 8th of 9 children of former Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. He's got a new book out on faith about the justices' religious beliefs. It's very interesting conversation because we get into Scalia the man a lot. And Chris has 2 books about his father. Both are available now, and I highly recommend them. So you're going to want to listen to the whole show. But first, oh boy, we got to get... I feel like one of those guys who was charged with throwing the graphite bricks off the roof at Chernobyl in that HBO miniseries. You go out there and you can work for 90 seconds and then you have to come back and get scrubbed down. I feel like I need one of those kind of showers with like a bristle brush or maybe even a Brillo pad after watching these debates. The first one was bad enough, the undercard. Last night was even crazier. It started off, I've never seen more people. I don't know if Democrats realize this, and maybe it's because they know something we don't know. But I have never seen anybody pander to people who can't vote more than that. You don't see, you know, the race for the next British prime minister, and all they do is talk about all the benefits they want to give Americans. You're not going to see that because that would be insane. You're not going to see, you know, when they go to replace Angela Merkel, they're not going to say, well, the German people would like to offer the following benefits to the French. No, that's not how it works. But in the United States, somehow, the candidates for the one of two major parties in this country have spent the last 2 nights pandering in every way humanly possible to illegal aliens. That tells you the power of the identity politics that they have just marinated this country in and marinated their voters in. If you're Hispanic, you're supposed to care. You're supposed to feel personal about the plight of people you've never met, people you will never meet, because they happen to share a skin tone with you and a common heritage. There are thousands, millions. There are millions of Hispanic Americans who have no connection to wherever it is their families are from, and they're perfectly fine with it. Many of them don't speak Spanish, believe it or not. Yet, there we go. We've had three of them on the first night pandering and speaking in Spanish, saying, I will make sure that everybody who comes here makes sure that they get health care, a house, a job, free college. Their kids will have the best dental care. Meanwhile, by the way, a lot of these people running for president on the Democratic side are from California and New York, where I don't know if you've been to these places lately or seen any news stories about these places lately, but there is a rather incredibly large homeless population. I mean, my God, Los Angeles has medieval diseases making a comeback because of the rats and human feces on the street. In San Francisco, you have to forget steel toe boots. You have to wear steel-soled boots because of all the hypodermic needles from the junkies who live on the street. Not to mention the feces there. Yet, these representatives of the people of those areas are saying, we're not going to address that. What homeless problem? I haven't heard in two debates anybody talk about the homeless problem. You want to talk about compassion, Kamala Harris? Maybe talk about some compassion for the Americans you actually have to pole vault over if you happen to be walking down the streets in Los Angeles or San Francisco. But no. Nope, didn't come up. Not an issue. The sweet, sweet, nourishing illegal alien, our moral betters, they get all the attention. They get all the perks. Kate Steinle's name did not come up in either one of these debates, not from the moderators who are all on the Democrats' team, nor any of the Democrats. I wonder if the employees of NBC News are banned from speaking Kate Steinle's name or just have never heard of her because they get their news from NBC. It's unclear. Listen to this little bit. It was a show of hands, but you can tell by the applause of the barking seal audience that was pre-selected of Democrat Party primary voters, the answer. There is not a single hand that remains unraised in this. I'm surprised some of them didn't put both hands and one leg up. But listen to the question, and this is the priority of the Democratic Party.
Raise your hand if your government plan would provide coverage for undocumented immigrants. Okay. Let me start with you, Mayor Buttigieg. Why?
That is an audience of presumed taxpayers, at least some of them, yet they collapsed in unison over the prospect of their tax dollars and the massive debt we would incur because of it being spent on illegal aliens, making sure that they have health insurance, that their coverage is taken care of. Oh, they want to take care of you, too. But they want to make sure that while you're paying for everything that you don't need, that you're also paying for the illegal aliens. They also want to decriminalize crossing the border, and they want to stop deportations. Yet they say they're not for open borders. If there was a way to define open borders without using the expression of the terms that I just did, I don't know what it is, and I happen to make my living with words. They are for open borders, but you put those two words together and suddenly they cringe. They say, no, we're for humane treatment. We need to get these people into the country and give them jobs and the ability to work and put them on a pathway to citizenship. Well, you would be a complete moron if you lived in any third world hellhole anywhere on the planet if one of these people became president and you didn't make a mad dash for the border. They want to lay out the red carpet for you. They'll lay it right over the homeless people, the homeless Americans. To hell with them. Don't worry, the carpet's a little lumpy up ahead. But if it groans, don't worry about it. Just keep moving along. And we've got your public housing set up and your voter registration form is sitting on your coffee table. This is the Democratic Party. It was a disgusting display. Of course, the commentators on cable news were falling all over themselves going, oh, what a wonderful, compassionate group of people these are. Before we get to the fireworks that were there, but with Kamala Harris, which her mother was a scientist and her father was a college professor. I'm not really sure that I want to see some fact checking on her busing story. But before we get to that, there's a couple of other clips I want to play. One of them does involve Kamala Harris. One of them, listen to this question this the moderator from Telemundo. He made a little bit of a boo-boo here, but it's more of a Freudian slip, since Democrats really seem to consider anybody who wanders across the border an American citizen. The way he phrased this question, while technically wrong, is realistically just a couple of years early, considering the Democratic Party's policies.
Vice President, the Obama-Biden administration was... The Obama-Biden administration deported more than 3 million Americans.
Whoa, did I miss a memo? Are Americans being deported now? No, of course, that's not how it works. Like I said, it's a Freudian slip. You deported Americans. No. They were illegal aliens. They were mostly turned back at the border and counted as deportations, like I said yesterday. But not Americans. Not yet. Anyway, if any one of those people becomes president, you'd better believe they're going to be Americans. Let's see, who else? Mayor Pete. Mayor Pete was surprisingly a non-entity at this. I thought he answered his question about the problems with the police shooting back in South Bend, or whatever city he was mayor of, fairly well. Except for the fact that he went on and said, I'm not allowed to take sides in this. And then he talked about the systemic racism in police across the country, which is kind of like saying the police are horrible. It's also like saying, hey, yeah, our police officer killed a black guy, but you know what? All cops are racist. So what are you going to do? Of course, the police officer says that the guy he shot came at him with a knife. You don't really hear that very often, but... Pete, for the audience that he was dealing with, they don't care about the truth. They care about the narrative. And as long as it sounds like Pete is on top of it, they're perfectly fine with it. I want to take issue with something else that he said and got a lot of applause for about Republicans and Christians.
Got to talk about one other thing, because the Republican Party likes to cloak itself in the language of religion. Now, our party doesn't talk about that as much. Largely for a very good reason, which was we are committed to the separation of church and state, and we stand for people of any religion and people of no religion, but we should call out hypocrisy when we see it. And for a party that associates itself with Christianity, to say that it is okay to suggest that God would smile on the division of families at the hands of federal agents, that God would condone putting children in cages, has lost all claim to ever use religious language again.
You can never use religious language again because the gay mayor from Indiana said that you can't do that. He's for abortion up until after birth, but you know what? God would probably be cool with that because everybody knows that God makes life sometimes by accident or something. I mean, the nerve of that, and the audience, of course, applauds. Nobody said, hey, wait a second, that's a bridge too far. That's a little bit ridiculous. Nope. They all cheered. Those damn religious conservatives, they despise Christians. They despise Christians. They absolutely loathe them. I love him. We respect the separation of church and state. No, you don't, Pete. First of all, everything you guys talk about that you want to do, meaning taking things from the people who earn them to give them to and for buying the vote purposes to people who didn't and won't earn, is done because it's the moral thing to do. We're always told it's more. You can't legislate morality, but you guys sure seem to want to legislate based on morality. The hypocrisy, you want to call out hypocrisy. Yes, I don't think you're very good at separating church and state, Mayor Pete, because your church is the state. The progressives' church is the state. All glory unto God. Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar. Render unto God that which is God. And to the left, that is everything, and it's both. They just want it all. They want to control you, and they're willing to say garbage like that in order to get applause lines and in order to make, to win votes, to buy votes with your money. It's not bribery if you're buying votes with somebody else's money. Along these lines that the government is supposed to provide for people, the goons at MSNBC, and I assume on CNN too, you can only stomach one of these things at a time, thought that Kamala Harris won the debate because of one exchange with Joe Biden. But Kamala Harris said a lot of incredibly stupid things throughout the debate. The worst is this: when she tried to play the mom up on stage, when a bunch of people were talking, she said, hey, people didn't tune in to see a food fight. Well, listen to it for yourself.
Okay, guys, you know what? America does not want to witness a food fight. They want to know how we're going to put food on their table. Yes.
And of course, the crowd goes wild. No, Kamala Harris, I don't want to know how you're going to put food on my table. I'll put food on my table. People should put food on their tables, their own damn tables. The problem is government has absolved them of that responsibility, and so they raise a bunch of shitty kids who look to the government as their parent, and a lot of parents who go, well, the government will take care of it, so I can just go out and party. I don't have to worry. I can use my money to get another tattoo. The government, how they want to know how we're going to put food on their table. How about they're going to learn how you're going to get the government's boot off their neck so they can go take care of themselves? How about you're going to put the government's boot up their ass a little bit to kind of get them to go and do for themselves? Because far too many people in this country haven't been doing for themselves, thanks to this very mentality that you people have instilled in them. Everybody up on stage up there wants to put food on your table. They don't actually want to put food on your table. You're a taxpayer, a working American. They want to take food out of your mouth and put it on somebody else's table. And the audience just went wild. Oh, this is wonderful. Yes, that's right. Here's a little pro tip for you, ladies and gentlemen. If you're sitting around waiting for the government to put food on your table, or money in your pocket, or a roof over your head, or clothing on your back, or anything else, and you're an able-bodied adult human being, you have failed at life, and you suck, and you need to get your act together, you need to get off your ass. Your life will never amount to anything. Suckling the government teat will not make you a better person. It will not make you a better parent. It will not make you rich. It will keep you right where you are, and it'll be you make you dependent on that teat. And your life will fall apart. But every single person up on that stage and every person in that audience applauded that and thought it was wonderful. They thought it was great. Now, Harris, that was overlooked, of course, because it's a Democratic Party debate. They don't really care about this. The more people who are dependent on government, the better. Chuck Todd's questions were asinine. He's not going to question them. Rachel Maddow is convinced that Vladimir Putin is somehow trying to mess with her questions, so she's not going to ask any questions. Harris was given the trophy for winning this debate, not because of that, not because of anything else she said. She just sounds like a lecturing, narc. I don't know, like the obnoxious mom in the neighborhood to me. She won the night, according to the Spinmeisters, and Chris Matthews' first question to her afterwards was, is Joe Biden done? All because of this exchange. Listen to Kamala Harris. Now, pay close attention to this at the very beginning, because Kamala Harris wasn't asked a question. She's jumping in. She saw an opening to deliver a prepared line. And you're saying, how can you say that, Derek? You don't know that. Well, at the same time she was delivering that line, her Twitter account tweeted out a picture of her as a young schoolgirl. I doubt highly they had that thing just sitting around. It's somebody, it's in the office. Hey, yeah, here's an old snapshot of Kamala Harris getting ready to go off to school. Let's tweet that out because it's relevant to what she's talking about. No, this was planned. I know exactly how this works. Nobody brought this up in the media, but there's no way this was spontaneous. It all comes down to, back to the point. When you hear Rachel Maddow Kamala Harris interrupt Rachel Maddow's trying to ask a question, basically says, I'm going to come to you with this question. Rachel Maddow says, you have 30 seconds. 30 seconds. The clip I'm about to play you is just a little over 2 minutes long. Rachel Maddow does not interrupt after 30 seconds. She doesn't interrupt after 45 seconds. She lets the whole damn thing play out. I see this as a hit job on Joe Biden. Not that he doesn't deserve it, but I see this as a hit job on Joe Biden. It's the only time the moderators let somebody go for four times as long as they were supposed to when they weren't asked a question. And it was because Kamala Harris jumped in and says, "A black woman, I got to say something about this." And then she knew, Rachel knew what was coming. Chuck Todd knew what was coming. It was a telegraphed punch. Why Joe Biden wasn't better prepared for it, I don't know. But the moderators were in on this, not in the planning. They didn't get it ahead of time, but they sat back. They violated the rules for this moment specifically.
President Biden, we're going to get to you. Hang on. We're going to get to you.
Stage, I would like to speak on the issue of race.
We will give you 30 seconds, since we're going to come back to you on this again in just a moment. Go for 30 seconds.
Okay. So, on the issue of race, I couldn't agree more that this is an issue that is still not being talked about truthfully and honestly. There is not a black man I know, be he a relative, a friend, or a coworker, who has not been the subject of some form of profiling or discrimination. Growing up, my sister and I had to deal with the neighbor who told us her parents couldn't play with us because we were black. And I will say also that in this campaign, we've also heard, and I'm going to now direct this at Vice President Biden, I do not believe you are a racist. And I agree with you when you commit yourself to the importance of finding common ground. But I also believe, and it's personal, and it was hurtful to hear you talk about the reputations of two United States senators who built their reputations and career on the segregation of race in this country. And it was not only that, but you also worked with them to oppose busing. And, you know, there was a little girl in California who was part of the second class to integrate her public schools. And she was bused to school every day. And that little girl was me. So I will tell you that on this subject, it cannot be an intellectual debate among Democrats. We have to take it seriously.
It was that one moment that every Democrat across, oh, she's just wonderful. She's painting herself as the victim and the hero of her own story. And then her team tweeted out the picture of her as a young schoolgirl, or the tweet about busing. There is no way in God's green earth that wasn't planned. That goes on. She goes on. She keeps rambling. That's a lot longer than 30 seconds that Rachel Maddow was talking about there. The moderators sat on their hands and let her attack Joe Biden like that. I thought it was, from a political standpoint, you got to admire it. It was perfectly planned. She played as the black woman, only black person up here, I would like to talk about race. You're going to get a question, but no. I've already started this ball rolling. I have something that we've rehearsed that I have to say. And she goes on to breathlessly recount this story like she grew up the daughter of sharecroppers in South Carolina. She grew up the daughter of a scientist and a college professor in California, not exactly the Deep South. So I want to see some fact-checking on this story. Maybe it's true. I don't know, but I would think that maybe there's a good chance she went to a public or a private school. She might have gone to a public school. Who knows? But oftentimes when a politician tells you a story that's this perfect, there's a lot more to the story than there is. When she was 12 years old, she moved apparently to Quebec with her mother after her parents split. So there's just a lot about this that I question. I'm not saying it's false, but I would like to see some actual reporting. Nobody asked her about it. They just congratulated her for it. Nobody asked her about if it was slobbering after that moment. It might as well have, they might as well have just ended the debate right there, because nothing else was going to matter. They had their moment. It was about gender. It was about race. It was about victimhood. And it was slamming Joe Biden. It gave them the fireworks that they wanted. Joe Biden, for his part, had a good line about he, after law school, went to work in the public defender's office rather than to become a prosecutor, which is Kamala Harris's Achilles heel, that she was a prosecutor. She put away a lot of black and brown people in prison. for long periods of time and used to brag about it, and now she's kind of apologetic and dodging about it. But for the most part, Joe Biden, the leader, he didn't show up in the spin room. He wasn't interested in doing post-debate interviews. Maybe it's because it was well past his bedtime. He'd already had the blue plate special at 3:30 and was ready for bed. But he answered some things that were so rambling and so bizarre that I really think that he's kind of losing it. I mean, the guy's 76 years old, but I think he's losing it. He was talking about health insurance, and he went on to talk about how he wants to put health insurance company executives in prison for their misleading drug ads and the opioid crisis, which health insurance and drug companies are two entirely different companies. He switched who he was attacking in midstream and never picked up on it. And then there's this little bit. When asked, the question is, what is the first thing? What is your priority when you become president? Because Chuck Todd had this long rambling question about the president wanted to do two things when he came into office, and that was health care and climate change. And he can only really pick one to get done in his first 2 years, and he went with health care. What will be your top priority? He swore that he wanted to do immigration reform, but he didn't even bother trying to do that, weirdly enough, because Democrats love having the issue. Chuck Todd knows that, theoretically. He's not going to say that because he's on the team. His wife made like $3 million last election off of Bernie Sanders consulting for them. So why would he crap where he eats? But Joe Biden's answer, remember the question, the first thing you would do if you were president of the United States, Joe defends Obama, and then he says the first thing he would do is, well, something that it's just Joe being Joe. It's self-explanatory, I think.
I think you're so underestimating what Barack Obama did. He's the first man to bring together the entire world, 196 nations, to commit to deal with climate change immediately. So I don't buy that. But the first thing I would do is make sure that we defeat Donald Trump, okay. Period.
It was that one moment that every Democrat across, oh, she's just wonderful. She's painting herself as the victim and the hero of her own story. And then her team tweeted out the picture of her as a young schoolgirl, of the tweet about busing. There is no way in God's green earth that wasn't planned. That goes on. She goes on. She keeps rambling. That's a lot longer than 30 seconds that Rachel Maddow was talking about there. The moderators sat on their hands and let her attack Joe Biden like that. I thought it was, from a political standpoint, you got to admire it. It was perfectly planned. She played this is a black woman, only black person up here. I would like to talk about race. You're going to get a question, but no. I've already started this ball rolling. I have something that we've rehearsed that I have to say. And she goes on to breathlessly recount this story like she grew up the daughter of sharecroppers in South Carolina. She grew up the daughter of a scientist and a college professor in California, not exactly the Deep South. So I want to see some fact-checking on this story. Maybe it's true. I don't know, but I would think that maybe there's a good chance she went to a public or a private school. She might have gone to a public school. Who knows? But oftentimes when a politician tells you a story that's this perfect, there's a lot more to the story than there is. When she was 12 years old, she moved apparently to Quebec with her mother after her parents split. So there's just a lot about this that I question. I'm not saying it's false, but I would like to see some actual reporting. Nobody asked her about it. They just congratulated her for it. Nobody asked her about it. It was slobbering after that moment. It might as well have, they might as well have just ended the debate right there, because they had, nothing else was going to matter. They had their moment. It was about gender. It was about race. It was about victimhood. And it was slamming Joe Biden. It gave them the fireworks that they wanted. Joe Biden, for his part, had a good line about he, after law school, went to work in the public defender's office rather than to become a prosecutor, which is Kamala Harris's Achilles heel, that she was a prosecutor. She put away a lot of black and brown people in prison for long periods of time and used to brag about it, and now she's kind of apologetic and dodging about it. But for the most part, Joe Biden, the leader, he didn't show up in the spin room. He wasn't interested in doing post-debate interviews. Maybe it's because it was well past his bedtime. He'd already had the blue plate special at 3:30 and was ready for bed. But he answered some things that were so rambling and so bizarre that I really think that he's kind of losing it. I mean, the guy's 76 years old, but I think he's losing it. He was talking about health insurance, and he went on to talk about how he wants to put health insurance company executives in prison for their misleading drug ads and the opioid crisis, which health insurance and drug companies are two entirely different companies. He switched who he was attacking in midstream and never picked up on it. And then there's this little bit. When asked, the question is, what is the first thing? What is your priority when you become president? Because Chuck Todd had this long rambling question about the president wanted to do two things when he came into office, and that was health care and climate change. And he can only really pick one to get done in his first 2 years, and he went with health care. What will be your top priority? He swore that he wanted to do immigration reform, but he didn't even bother trying to do that, weirdly enough, because Democrats love having the issue. Chuck Todd knows that, theoretically. He's not going to say that because he's on the team. His wife made like $3 million last election off of Bernie Sanders consulting for them. So why would he crap where he eats? But Joe Biden's answer, remember the question, the first thing you would do if you were president of the United States. Joe defends Obama, and then he says the first thing he would do is, well, something that it's just Joe being Joe. It's self-explanatory, I think.
I think it was a tougher night for the most seasoned candidates on the platform for Vice President Biden. Because they seemed like part of the past rather than the future. At times, the vice president seemed somewhat confused to me in handling some of the questions and following some of the actions. He seemed a bit defensive. And Bernie Sanders, we joked earlier, he might have been a hologram, because a lot of what we heard tonight, we've heard many, many times before. So I think they seemed a little bit mired in the past.
Brutal assessment from Axelrod, who, you know, theoretically should be on Joe's team since, you know, it was Obama-Biden. But I think they marginalized Joe Biden right away, I thought. I think they wanted nothing to do with Joe. It was more of a, we got to get somebody up here who's older on the ticket so people feel a little more comfortable. And that was it. Actually, a couple more clips. Let me just get to them really quickly. Listen to Kamala Harris on the economy. She's trying to convince people that the economy is in the toilet, even though it's clearly not.
Part of the issue that is at play in America today, and we've all been traveling around the country, I certainly have, I'm meeting people who are working 2 and 3 jobs. You know, this president walks around talking about and flouting his great economy, right? My great economy, my great economy. You ask him, well, how are you measuring this greatness of this economy of yours? And he talks about the stock market. Well, that's fine if you own stocks. So many families in America do not. You ask them, how are you measuring the greatness of this economy of yours? And they point to the jobless numbers and the unemployment numbers. Well, yeah, people in America are working. They're working 2 and 3 jobs. So when we talk about jobs, let's be really clear. In our America, no one should have to work more than one job to have a roof over their head and food on the table.
Thank you very much.
No one should ever have to work more than one job ever under any, no matter how, you know, a part-time job. How about a fast food job? How about a Walmart greeter job? That should be enough for people to live on. Here's a little thing about Kamala Harris. She, again, is from California, where it is ridiculously expensive to buy a house. Incredibly expensive. And it's only going to get more expensive because they now mandate that any new home built be built with solar panels on the roof. Solar panels ain't cheap. So you add another 10, 20, 30, 40 grand to the price of an already expensive
house that's built on a ridiculously expensive piece of property because so much of the state is restricted from building new properties. And yes, people have to work 3 and 4 and 2 and 3 jobs. Why? Because they choose to live in places like Los Angeles, San Francisco, or New York. If you want to live off of one job, move to Montana. You can live there fairly inexpensively. Move to North Dakota. You can live quite well up there off of one job, especially if you're in the fracking field. It's about where you live, but these liberals have a big city mentality. They don't give a crap about the rest of the country. They want to dictate policies that will ruin small town America because their liberal policies have ruined big city America, where it's crime ridden and nobody can afford to live, or nobody wants to live, but people can't escape and the schools are terrible. They want to cater to them at the expense of everybody else who lives in middle-sized towns, who lives in the suburbs, and decides that, you know what, I can only afford to buy a house that's an hour away from where I work, so my commute is going to be an hour. I could buy more house than I can afford. If the government will come in and bail me out, why not? But I'm gonna, if I wanted to live closer to work, but it makes more sense to me to buy the house that I can't afford and commute for an hour. Well, you're a sucker in the Democrats' world. They want to make sure that you get taxed to subsidize people who aren't willing to make that commitment to themselves and to life in general. Anyway, I'm going really long here, and I just want to wrap it up with Marianne Williamson. I didn't hear enough from Andrew Yang. Andrew Yang's one big shot. I was curious to hear the guy talk when he did. It was kind of interesting and entertaining, but he was not. He just shut up for most of the debate. I think he went out for a sandwich. Same with Marianne Williamson. I didn't know that she was like a friend of Oprah and kind of like a guru. She's a hippy-dippy lady. I just want to play closing statement. It's about 45 seconds long, and it sums up what we saw the last 2 days pretty well.
I'm sorry we haven't talked more tonight about how we're going to beat Donald Trump. I have an idea about Donald Trump. Donald Trump is not going to be beaten just by insider politics talk. He's not going to be beaten just by somebody who has plans. He's going to be beaten by somebody who has an idea what this man has done. This man has reached into the psyche of the American people, and he has harnessed fear for political purposes. So, Mr. President, if you're listening, I want you to hear me, please. You have harnessed fear for political purposes, and only love can cast that out. So I, sir, I have a feeling you know what you're doing. I'm going to harness love for political purposes. I will meet you on that field, and, sir, love will win.
She got enough donors and polled high enough in the Democratic field to make the debate stage, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, good Lord. And that was just one of her many, many ridiculously weird, trippy, dippy answers. Somebody posted on Twitter during one of her talks that it was the first time on television you got to watch somebody get high off an edible. It really, the power of Oprah, man. She should have worn a lapel pin. Like, I was a Oprah book club person, spiritual guru up there, made the stage. She'll probably be on the stage in the next debate. I think it's next month. And then I suspect she will fade away and go back to however she made her millions off of suckers. Actually, they all made their millions off of suckers, because in one way or another, they made their money off of us, off the public. These people must not be allowed to be president of the United States. Anyway, up next is the Christopher Scalia interview. I hope you like it. Shoot me an email. Let me know if you did. Otherwise, have a great weekend. Independence Day next weekend. Special interviews all week. New interview back on Friday. If massive news breaks, I'll find a way to get it to you. Otherwise, there'll be new intros. I'll ramble and all that, but it'll be some of the greatest hits that we've had, and we've had some impressive guests so far. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week.
Oh! All righty. Hello again, everyone, and welcome to it, the Daily Caller podcast, the Friday video interview edition, unless you're listening to the audio show, at which point it just turns to me yelling at random in your ears. Welcome to the show. Today, we've dragged in somebody from their life. We do it every time. We grab somebody off the street during a week and make them talk to us for a little while. This week, we actually nab somebody of note, noted author and former professor of English.
That's right.
Christopher Scalia, he has a new book out. He's editor of Antonin Scalia on Faith, which is what I'm holding right here, Lessons from an American Believer. I'll stand that up right there. He's also author of Scalia Speaks, Reflections on Law, Life, Law, Faith, and a Life Well Lived. Welcome to the show, Christopher.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming in.
My pleasure.
First of all, Scalia, you're writing about Antonin Scalia, and your last name is Scalia. Is there any relationship?
No, this is a coincidence. I am actually one of his children.
Well, he's got enough of them.
I tell people when they seem surprised or amazed to meet one of his kids, I'm like, well, it's bound to happen sooner or later.
You're the eighth of nine,
yeah.
How was growing up? Let's just talk about that.
It was fun. I liked growing up in a crowded house.
How many bathrooms?
Well, it depended on where we were living at the time. I don't remember lack of bathrooms being a big issue, though.
I watch a lot of HGTV, yeah, and I see these couples with no kids, and we need at least three bathrooms.
No.
And we have to have a double vanity. I remember growing up, five kids, two parents, and a dog, one bathroom, one sink in the bathroom.
Yeah. Well,
nobody died waiting for the bathroom.
Yeah, my parents always had their own bathroom, but the kids, obviously, we would always share the bathroom, and I would annoy the younger siblings, and their grosser habits would always annoy the older siblings in their more hygienic ways. But we got along. We all survived.
I'm the youngest of five. I'm the baby.
Okay, that's pretty good. Five is not bad.
Everybody had their act together before I came along and screwed it up.
Yeah, but five is a lot, and I imagine your family's experience was a little bit like ours, which is that there are generation gaps within the family.
Yes.
And the experiences my older siblings had were very different from the ones I had growing up, and my little sister.
Span. What's the age span?
I think it's 18 years.
18
years. From oldest to my little sister. Good yeah.
Lord. Yeah. You're totally different.
Yeah.
And the hand-me-downs were.
Yeah. Yeah. Like in 1984, I was wearing pants from 73. So I was really popular.
Now your pictures are considered retro. Cool.
Yes, exactly. I should have held on to some of those pants. My son could be wearing them
now. There you go. I want to talk about both books, because both books sort of paint a picture of your father. And I encourage you to fill it in with anecdotes at all. But first and foremost, before we get to either of the books, your father, Supreme Court Justice, on the Supreme Court almost your whole adult life.
Yeah.
You didn't know him as a Supreme Court justice, but everybody who knew you knew him as that.
Yeah.
How was that growing up? Because my dad drove a forklift. You know,
Goes,
oh my God, there's that guy's dad drives a forklift. Look at him. Quick, take some pictures. You had to worry, especially in your teen years, if you did something stupid, as all teenagers do, it's not just the kid down the block did something stupid, set a fire to a field. It was, which I did. I did. it was Supreme Court Justice's son does this. So how did that impact you?
It did make me a little bit more aware of my behavior and what I did.
Did your father have a conversation with you at some point and say?
No, I don't remember that ever happening. I just kind of knew that that he was in the public eye, and I guess I had probably seen it happen to other prominent people's kids getting in trouble or something like that. But I just kind of knew that if I did, even if it didn't get me in the newspaper, it could reflect poorly on my dad. And that doesn't mean I was a perfect teenager or anything like that. But it did add an extra level. I was 10 when he was confirmed to the Supreme Court in 1986. And I remember the day he was Reagan made the announcement, or the day after we went over to our neighborhood pool, and I just remember immediately just kind of it was different because
everybody's kind of
my dad was on the news and people were looking at me. So but it was, especially growing up in Northern Virginia, it wasn't that weird because I went to Dan Quayle's kids went to my high school for a little while, and there were other children whose fathers were mothers were pretty prominent.
Yeah, your father had been in Washington for a while and part of the scene, so you
were exactly
sort of into that.
But. Yeah.
Did he change at all?
I don't think so.
I mean, you were only 10, but
yeah, I I mean, we were more settled as a family, but we kind of already were because he was a federal judge even before he was nominated to the court. But we were talking about kind of generational differences. My older siblings lived a much less settled life than I did because my dad was bouncing around from job to job makes it seem like he couldn't hold a job right. down, which it wasn't. But, you know, he was a professor. Promoted. Well, the joke was that he kept going from job to job, each one paying less than the one before. But, you know, he was in think tanks and he was a college professor and he worked for presidential administration. So they moved around a lot. So the biggest change, I think, for the family was just that we were in the public eye more, but also it was just more settled from the early 80s on.
Obviously, when somebody finds out who your father was, they have a million questions, like me. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you think is – what would you say is the biggest misconception, mm-hmm. Public misconception about what kind of a man and what kind of a father your father was?
I think my father – I'm talking primarily about kind of negative perceptions of him,
right.
things his detractors would believe. I think he was a lot more charming and a lot funnier than his – detractors.
He was probably. Very funny was from very the funny. Bench.
Yeah. From the bench and yeah, I mean all the time. He was a great joke teller. He was a little bit of a ham. And I think that's why these two collections of speeches, they are speeches and he loved delivering speeches in large part because he was a ham. He kind of had a flair for the dramatic and the theatrical. So that comes through in his opinions a little bit, but especially in his speeches. But then again, in more casual settings, just his joke telling and his storytelling. He was a lot of fun to listen to. You know, you mentioned that I was a college professor, and that's really when things were weirdest for me because I was an English professor, and my father isn't necessarily academia's favorite Supreme Court
what?
Justice ever. Yeah, it's hard
Can't
to believe.
Be.
So
then it's Clarence Thomas, right?
Yeah,
it's
one of the, yeah exactly.
They always finish
it's
one and two in those polls.
Exactly. So that sometimes led to pretty awkward situations. People who knew me were always very nice, but I would go to conferences or something and people would see the last name and assume that because I didn't have like a tail or something, that mm-hmm. there was no relation. And so they would proceed to tell me, oh, too bad you have that last name. I hate that guy. And I would have to.
Did they ever throw that? That's my dad?
Well, yeah.
And did they change their tune?
They got awkward. Sometimes they would apologize.
Back away
sometimes
slowly.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes they would just run away screaming.
Your father passed away unexpectedly. Mm-hmm. And the aftermath of that, I lost my mother a year and a half ago. I don't want to get into that with you. That's not something anybody likes to talk about.
Yeah.
But at what point do you decide? Because he's voluminous papers, mm-hmm. speeches, notes, everything you can possibly imagine. And even before he was on the bench, I imagine articles. Mm-hmm. What made you decide to go through them? Was it just a sort of, I want to mm-hmm. be closer to him? And then you thought, hey, there's some stuff in here that would be good. Or how did the books come about?
I wish I could take credit, but basically came down to the fact that
I won't fact check you, so you yeah. can tell me whatever story you want.
My mommy asked me to do it, so
right.
Yeah. My I got a phone call from my one of my older brothers who said that he and mom had, you know, thought this would be a good idea to put together some speeches, and they wanted to put me and Ed Whalen, who's one of my dad's former clerks, in charge of it. And I knew that he had a lot of papers. But I thought the process of getting them and going through them was further down the road. So I jumped at the chance because I loved his speeches. Obviously I'd heard him give a number of them, and I think it's rare to hear a kid say I loved it when my father delivered speeches to me. But I actually really did like
the difference between speeches and lectures.
Yeah, exactly. Good point. or orders.
Yes.
And we started the first collection less than a year after he died. And I really did grow closer to him. I got to, you know, I had no interest in going into the law. I read his opinions. I followed his career, if you want to put it that way. But I went in a very different direction. I had no interest in following his path because it was just.
Any of your siblings
already,
go into the law?
Yeah. Two of my older brothers did. But I was so young when he was on the court. I think that was kind of a different situation for me. But But so that in a way, working on these collections brought me into his career even more than I was. And that meant a lot to me. And then reading through the speeches so shortly after he died was cathartic, because it was like hearing his voice again.
Going through his papers, his personal papers, and you said it made you feel closer to him. Were you surprised by anything you found?
I was surprised by a lot of things. First, I knew he delivered a lot of speeches, but I didn't realize how many speeches he delivered, how many different speeches he delivered, and the number of groups he spoke to. Our first collection includes a speech he delivered at a wild turkey convention, wild turkey hunting convention.
Okay. They go hunting, or both?
Probably both. he received an award at one of these conventions, and he delivered a speech. It was a great speech about the Second Amendment and also why he loves hunting. And so we were surprised by things like that. He also delivered a speech that's in both of the collections, Scalia Speaks and On Faith, that he delivered about the importance of religious expression in American public life. And he delivered it to a really small, I think, a naval air base in Cherry Point, North Carolina, I think it is.
How do you get a Supreme Court justice to show up at a naval base?
My co-editor, Ed Whalen, tracked down the person who invited him. And the guy said, yeah, I really didn't think he would reply, but he took me up on the offer, and it was I can't remember the man's name, but he said it was one of the highlights of his military career. And there are a few stories like that. He delivered a speech I didn't know he delivered at Juilliard School of the Arts. Again, not the sort of environment or setting you'd imagine for at least a conservative Supreme Court justice.
But he loved opera.
That's why he was invited. Yeah, I talked to the president of the school who invited him, Joseph Polisi, and he said that he knew my dad loved opera, so he'd be kind of at home and have something to talk about anyway. And he also knew, to his credit, that my dad would say things that this audience wouldn't otherwise hear.
And that was when you could go and talk to a group of people who you didn't necessarily agree with, and they wouldn't stand up and throw milkshakes at you.
Exactly. And my dad gave a really good speech too. I think he won the crowd over immediately by kind of making fun of himself, but then also challenged the audience by saying some things that they probably didn't want to hear, in a nice way, of course, but kind of challenging their understanding of the First Amendment and government funding of the arts. You can imagine they had differing ideas about it. But it was a great speech. So things like that, surprising speeches he delivered. But then there were other things that I guess more personal things. There's one speech we didn't include because it frankly wasn't that interesting. But it was something about – it was either about libraries or just about conducting research. And in that speech, he describes how much he enjoyed doing research when he was a law student and a law professor, and how much he misses that now as a judge, because he has clerks to do those things. And he just kind of describes – sorry if this is getting really nerdy – but the excitement of doing research and making discoveries.
I loved doing proofs.
Yeah, there you go.
Was in geometry class. Well, that goes to show you when I was very young, I have vague memories of Ronald Reagan – coming to my town of Redford Township, Michigan, to a little Catholic school there, because somebody had written him, Mr. President, and he took them up on it. So send those letters to whoever you want, because you never, ever, ever know. Are you a fan of opera?
I am not. I try to get into classical music. I took all, after
classical
my father
music
passed
is
away.
Different from
I know.
Opera.
That's as close as I get, though. So I've been to an opera, and I've listened to my father listen and explain opera, but I've never gotten into it. Well, classical music is a little easier.
Classical music is easier because it's nice to have a soundtrack in your life that you don't have to pay attention to. It just fills the room
while you
think about other things. But opera demands your attention.
Yes, exactly. There's no escape.
It's got to be sucky when you're a kid and your dad's kicking out the jams of opera.
Especially he would usually when he played it at home, he had his headphones on. But driving to and from church, he would crank that to 11.
Well, that's a good segue into On Faith. Mm-hmm. It's a devout Catholic. Mm-hmm. But people, that can mean anything these days. People say, oh, I'm Catholic, and they're varying degrees. But talk about your father's faith. He came to it long before you were born, so you can't really talk about that journey. But talk about how important it was to him, both as a judge, a Supreme Court justice, as a man and as a father, which is much more important.
He was as far as I can tell, he was religious his entire life. There are stories, actually, we had an old friend of his contribute a short essay to this collection describing their friendship. And the story he tells goes back to their high school days. And this friend was discerning the priesthood, and dad basically encouraged him to do that. So, and he went to Catholic high school. He went to Georgetown. Catholic college, obviously. So
less so now.
Yeah, less so now. I think both are less so now. But he, and just, you know, growing up with my mom and my dad, Catholicism was just, it was always there. You mm-hmm. know, it was always the foundation of
the
our
Sunday,
family.
Wednesday church going family.
My mom did daily mass. My dad, my dad did holy days and Sundays, and we went to Sunday mass together all the time. He was home every night for dinner, which is I didn't realize how remarkable that was until I, you know, started my own family. And then he led every grace before meals every night. I like to joke that he sounded more like an auctioneer than like a priest leading the prayer, because he was in
Let's
a rush to get
through
food.
But I'm hungry.
I was all right. Yeah, I understood that, and I was in a rush too. But nonetheless, it was kind of an important thing for him to do, an important model to set. And he didn't lecture us about religion all the time. He chose his moments, and as a result, they were memorable. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you had a question or wanted to talk right. about religion, he was always happy to. But it's not something
it was obviously a part of your family, but did it ever feel forced upon you? Or
yeah, it really didn't. I can't speak for all of my siblings, but it never felt forced to me. I don't know how they did it, but they managed to make it just kind of a seamless part of our family life. And I don't remember any of us ever saying, "No, I'm not going to church" or anything like that. Even when we didn't have to go with them in the same car, we drove ourselves to different masses. It was just kind of understood. And it was.
Is your brother, who's the priest, the favorite?
He's not my favorite, I'll tell you that. Paul's great. Father Paul Scalia is my brother, and he wrote the introduction to this collection. And if actually, good segue on your part, by the way, you should. Should do this for a living.
I should. I just should do it for a living. Not really. I should find a way to get paid for doing it.
He describes my father's religion very well. He puts it this way: "For years, I have heard my father referred to as a devout Catholic. I always wince at that word, which typically describes one who comes easily to his religious practice, prays peacefully, and speaks naturally about his faith. That wasn't my father. He was indeed a man of faith and, in his own way, devout. But like everything else in his life, faith had something of an argument and contest about it. After all, this was the man who, when asked by reporters about how he responds to those who question his public practice of faith, he made a dismissive, misinterpreted by some as obscene, Italian gesture on his way out of mass." You listening at home should Google that. It was.
Is it on video?
You can. There's a picture of him. He basically rubbed the top of his hand under his chin,
okay, yeah.
Which means I don't care.
It's how you
but
doing.
Some people,
how you doing?
Yeah, some people took it differently. But anyway, my brother's point is, I think my brother's being accurate here, dad loved talking about religion. He loved arguing about it. And Justice Thomas, in his foreword to this collection, says something similar. He didn't think that he was that he should be anybody's model of religion. As important as it was to him. So he didn't seek out to convert people, but he had an enormous influence on many, many people just by how he acted out his religious life.
So lead by example,
yeah,
not
exactly.
preach.
Exactly.
Did you find any evidence? Everybody struggles with their faith at some point, in some mm-hmm. way, publicly, yeah. privately, more vocal about it than others. When you think of Antonin Scalia, you don't think of that. Nobody knows yeah. him as well as you guys did. But were there moments in his life where he's questioning things? Because bad things happen.
Yeah.
It makes everybody question things.
Paul tells a story in his introduction about talking to dad on the phone. And dad said, "Yeah, I've been praying the rosary. I've been praying the rosary every day," something like that. And Paul says, "Oh, that's great, dad." And dad said something like, "Yeah. Does it do any good?" So I think he had kind of the frustrations and doubts that most religious believers had. I don't think he ever doubted Catholicism. I know he wondered about, you know, certain directions the church went, especially in the 70s. But he never lost faith, as far as I know, in Catholicism itself. But he definitely was frustrated and expressed his dissatisfaction, for example, after bad masses or especially ugly liturgies, things like that.
Right. The being mad at the priest is different than being mad and distancing yourself from the faith. How did his faith – there are many misconceptions about every religious person, really, especially being thrown at them by the left. That it informs their – it controls, it commands their decisions, that you know that he's going to be against this, that, or the other thing because he's a Catholic.
Right.
They can't – they won't address the idea that there's a constitutional basis to impose those things, because your father would go against what I imagine was his personal beliefs because the Constitution commanded it. But how much did his faith inform his interpretation of the law and the Constitution? And how did that play out?
He liked to say that some vocations are much easier, make it a lot easier to apply your faith to them. Like if you're a doctor, a Catholic doctor, for example, you just can't perform abortions. That's the example you like to give. Other faiths or other professions are more difficult. So a short order chef who's Catholic can't make a Catholic hamburger except to cook the hamburger as well as he can. And he would say it's similar with being a judge. There's no Catholic way of interpreting a text or understanding the tradition behind a law or something like that. There's no Catholic way to do that except to do it as well as you can. And so when it came to positions that, you know, the left and his detractors would say were basically theocratic, he would tell his detractors and his supporters that he didn't rule as he did, for example, in cases of abortion because of his religious belief. If the Constitution clearly provided a right to an abortion, his oath would have commanded that he say as much. But because the Constitution said no such thing, that's why he ruled as he did in abortion cases. He used to tell Catholic groups in a speech we have in this collection, if you're honoring me or if you like my opinions on abortion because you think I arrive at those decisions because I'm Catholic, I'm sorry, but you've been misled. That's not why I arrive at those decisions. Justice Thomas in his foreword explains it another way. He says, you know, Dad's religion meant that he took his job very seriously, and that meant he had a particular, you know, constitutionally restrained vision of what his role was as a judge, and that was not to impose his own personal and religious beliefs in his decisions and on the American people. And going back to one of your earlier questions about what would surprise people, I think one thing that would surprise especially his detractors is that he had really a kind of humble job of what this – or humble vision of what a Supreme Court justice's job was. And it was not to impose his beliefs but to, you know, interpret the Constitution, as he would put it, according to its original public meaning. And you mentioned cases where he kind of ruled against his own beliefs. The flag-burning case is one – it's a 30-year-old case now. That's an example he liked to go to all the time, which doesn't have anything to do with religion, of course. But he would say that if it were up to him, you know, you wouldn't be able to burn a flag, but it's clearly protected by the First Amendment. And similarly, Fourth and Fifth Amendment cases about search and seizure and defendants' rights. He often strayed away from, you know, conservative public policy orthodoxy because of what the Constitution dictated.
I want to get into the what if game with you, but I don't want to. Yeah. I don't want. I'm just so tempted to say it. But as we're getting closer to the end here, just reflect a little bit about like what it meant to your father to be a person of faith.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how to put this in a way because people have this public perception of him, but it wasn't his job. It was his life. It was who he was.
Yeah.
People, especially not of faith, don't understand that. What can the non-believer, because you're not going to, but people who are the agnostics, I believe there's something out there, but I don't subscribe to any religions. Is sort of faith affirming that you found and put in the pages of On Faith?
Hmm. I don't know. I think a lot of what my father comes back to in many of his speeches is that being religious is difficult, especially in a secular world. And he would speak to many believers, especially Christians, about the difficulty of being a devout and strong Catholic in a secular age, and the necessity of coming to terms with that fact, not liking it, but just understanding that you will always feel a little bit alien in the secular world. And again, that doesn't really answer your question, but he wanted religious people to understand that it would be difficult to be religious very often, but if it wasn't, you probably weren't doing something right.
Again, I'm looking at this through the friends of my lefty friends who give me crap. I'm a Catholic, mm-hmm. but not nearly as good a Catholic as mm-hmm. I should have been. They almost can't imagine somebody like your father, whose mm-hmm. faith is that important to them mm-hmm. and that much a part of who they are, their public persona and their private persona. They can't imagine them being fun to be around, mm-hmm. having any friends who mm-hmm. might not be as devout. They think that when we're behind closed doors, any Catholic or anybody who identifies himself as any religion, all we do is read the Bible and judge other people.
Yeah.
And like, if you don't fit into this box that I need, mm-hmm. then I don't want anything to do with you.
Yeah.
I know that's not the case. That's impossible mm-hmm. to live that way, mm-hmm. unless you're a liberal in New York, and then you can have that worldview.
Yeah.
And you probably live that way. But how did your father react? And like, talk about your father's life in general, not from terms of faith, because he didn't say, well, you're not a Catholic, you're a Jew, or you're an atheist, or whatever, you're some sort of other thing. Just address that sort of insulated mentality that people have about people of faith.
Well, I'll approach it this way. One of his best friends was Justice Ginsburg, who...
Darth Vader Ginsburg, as I like to call her.
I don't call her that. Justice Ginsburg, if you're listening.
You called her that right before the show. I don't know what you're talking about. No.
So he was very good friends with her.
They didn't agree on much of anything except opera.
Exactly. And wine and good food.
So they had a little too much that one time.
They and – I'm avoiding these questions, these comments. So.
I highly doubt Ruth is – if you're listening, you're welcome on the show anytime, Darth.
But she and her husband were very good friends with my father and my mom, and they would socialize often. And people are baffled by that friendship, but it just came down to all the things they did have in common. And that included, as you mentioned, opera and good wine and good food and the friendship between her husband and my mother. And Justice Ginsburg and my dad both grew up in New York around the same time. I think they were kind of familiar types to each other, so that helped. And they had also a very good working relationship. They appreciated the feedback they gave each other on opinions, even if they were on other sides. So I think, you know, my father was able to get along with a lot of people. There's a picture.
There was genuine love between those two.
Yeah, it was. They celebrate. They had a big New Year's party every year where Mr. Ginsburg would he was basically a gourmet chef and would cook some knockout dinner. And they had cameos and operas together, things like that. So they wouldn't talk on the phone till like 1 a.m. You know, they weren't like high school buddies or anything, but they were very good friends. And I think it's easier for Supreme Court justices to have that kind of relationship because they're not campaigning against each other.
Right.
I think that's part of it. But they just had a friendship that went very far back, and they nurtured it based on the many things that they had in common.
Any justices he didn't like?
He got along with all of them. There were opinions he didn't like, but that was always clear from his dissents.
I could be wrong about this, but I have a friend who had dinner with your father, or says they did, and William Peter Blatty, the author of The Exorcist, who's also a very heavily active. His wife taught my marriage class when I was getting married.
Really? Yeah.
And he invited me to his house once to sign some books for me. It was very cool. But what kind of – just back to your life growing up. When you know, there's the guy who wrote The Exorcist. It had to be a pretty interesting life. What would you think people would be shocked by? Because even though William Peter Blatty was a devout Catholic and heavily active, and if you really think about The Exorcist, it's not mm-hmm. a horror book. It's a very religious book. What do you think what people would shock about the way that your family and your parents in particular lived?
I think people always expect – they always say, oh, gosh, your dinner table conversations must have been incredible. But we weren't – we did have some serious dinner table
conversations.
Nine
kids do not have fascinating dinner conversations.
We're throwing napkins at each other. Occasionally we burped. We would talk about television. When I was a kid, my dad would always go to me to find out the television lineup for that night. You know, that was easier when there were only like three networks.
Right.
But you know, so we watched TV together. It was in many ways just a pretty normal, fun place to be. But maybe, I don't know, he did a lot of yard work. Would that surprise people? I don't know.
It kind of would. I'm kind of shocked by that. So you've written about his life and his faith. What else do you want people to know about Antonin Scalia? Because there's going to be a lot of things.
Yeah.
You're in a weird situation. Your father is revered or reviled by people who neither of whom know him or ever met him. So in a way, what you're doing with these volumes is sort of setting out the public record from inside.
Yeah. I think a lot of what we're putting out there is already out there, but in opinions. And opinions, even though my father wrote great and accessible opinions, they're still opinions. So they're hard to wade through with all the footnotes and everything. But we just thought it was important to get these. The first book was for a general audience, and it touched on a lot of different issues. The second one on faith is just about religious topics. And, you know, one thing we haven't talked about is about the place he saw the founders creating for religious expression in the public square. And he was really worried that recent Supreme Court decisions were narrowing the place for religious expression. Mm-hmm. For example, a Supreme Court we have an excerpt from an opinion in here, a dissent where my father was dissenting from a decision that deemed it unconstitutional for a rabbi to deliver a non-denominational invocation before a high school commencement address or ceremony. My dad said that was obviously constitutional, and he would frequently kind of lay out the historical grounding for that, how often the founders referred to religion and prayed and mentioned God. You mentioned what-if questions. I don't know for sure how he would have decided in the recent Bladensburg Peace Cross case.
Right.
My hunch is he may have been satisfied with that decision. But basically, can a World War I memorial on public land that's in the shape of a cross is that the establishment of religion? Those are questions we're still dealing with, and he expressed his ideas about that pretty clearly in his opinions speeches.
We do see, and if you want, because a lot of this, you're not him, so you don't have, you're just informing on his words, but we are seeing religion pushed from the public square. It was originally shunned, kind of. Now it's almost being legislated out of existence. Talk a little bit about what you said there, your father's references to the founding of this country and his beliefs on the fact that it existing in the public square is not it being established.
Yeah, the founders believed that religion was a crucial source of virtue for the people. And that was important because this was a democracy or republic, as you know, but it was government by the people. The people making decisions, so they needed to be virtuous. Virtue couldn't be limited to the aristocracy. Virtue had to be spread through all the people, and not everybody found virtue in religion. There are obviously other sources of it, but religion was a primary source of it for many people, so it should be encouraged. And my father's concern was that, in large part, because the Supreme Court was closing that off, it would have serious repercussions on the people and consequently on the nation.
We're out of time. Last question for you. What do you want the 30-second takeaway on this? Because you have a perverted view, and I don't mean that in a perverted way. You have an interest. It's your father. You know, but what do you want the layman to know about your father and his faith? And to know about just your father in general and his legacy.
My father was a Catholic who took his religion seriously and took the Constitution seriously and recognized that there was a distinction between the two, but there was also the Constitution also provided a lot of room for the expression of religion.
It had to be tempting to just go against the Constitution and be faithful to his faith sometimes. It would have been really easy. We see that all the time from judges. But he managed to not do that. Christopher, thank you for coming in. I'm going to ask you to sign this copy
Absolutely.
For me.
Sure.
Could you sign this copy for me to give away?
I've got scribbles all over this one. Yeah.
All right. Well, then I'm going to ask you to draw two names. I'm going to have you read the names.
Okay.
Because
all right.
I have dyslexia, so if I read the names, I'll butcher it. You'll be forgiven by the audience.
Okay.
These are for the two of them. Pick anyone at random. Not that one. No.
Did I get two here? Is that one?
That's okay. Just one.
All right. First name is David. I'm going to go with Thaman here. Thaman.
There you go, David. Congratulations. Email
Congratulations.
Me. So there's winner number one.
All right.
Now dig in for a good one.
Let's go over here.
All the way
far
over there.
Outer limits.
What do you got?
Dennis Hubbard.
Dennis Hubbard.
Come on down.
Two dudes, or at least two people who identify as men. We don't want to judge. You just won signed copies of Shannon Bream's book. You'll be getting an email from me very soon. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks
for taking time out of your day.
Great
luck with the book. I was a huge fan of your father. His legacy will live on, hopefully, forever. It'll be an example.
So.
But you have to be kind of frustrated watching the court sometimes.
Yeah, but it was like that when he was on the court, too. So.
That's true. It's true. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's all the time we have. Enjoy the weekend. Be back here on Monday. Have a great one.
I'm going to harness love for political purposes. I will meet you on that field. And, sir, love will win.